You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome. My name is Andy Neal, and you're listening to the Hiker Podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome. My name is Andy Neal, and you're listening to the podcast that gets to know the hiker behind the trekking pole, the podcast that asks the why questions of hiking, the podcast that asks hikers and outdoors persons how has the outdoors changed them, and how are they changing the world around them. That's right. You're listening to the Hiker Podcast. It has been a hot minute, I know. There's been a lot that's happened, but it's all good because we're back, back again. The Hiker Podcast is back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? Guess who's back? Guess who? Okay, you guys get it. Anyways, the Hiker Podcast is back, and we are here with some old sponsors, some new sponsors, and a bunch of great episodes coming up. Thank you all for your patience. It's been on again, off again, all fall. I'm so sorry, y'all. I'm so sorry. But I want to let you all know about our sponsors. Y'all know Canuck Outdoors. That's Canuck, not C-Knock, not Knock. It's Canuck. C-N-O-C. Canuck. Makers of the carbon fiber cork trekking poles, the poles that I switched to after I broke my high-end trekking poles by a very well-known trekking pole company. And I've tried to break, but I can't. They're just that good. They're worth every penny. I love Canuck Outdoors, makers of the carbon fiber cork trekking poles. How many times can I say carbon fiber cork trekking poles? They're a B Corp. They are just amazing. And they're also makers of all your water storage needs. Yeah, check them out. Link in the description of this episode. But I'm also very excited to announce our new sponsor to the show. I've been an ambassador for this company for a while, Gregory Mountain Products. You all probably know them online as Gregory Packs, makers of the first line of plus-size packs. Amazing company. I've done a lot of work with them, not only online, but in person, and got to see their headquarters in Salt Lake. And such an amazing company. I'm so excited to have them on board supporting the Hiker Podcast. And I've had already so many of the Gregory Pack ambassadors. I've had three on so far. And we'll have lots more on the show in the future. But I'm super excited for this week's episode, which was recorded back in October. I apologize. It happens. Sarah Redlaird is the founder and executive director of Bee Girl Organization, a grassroots nonprofit centered on bee habit conservation through research. Sorry, my glasses were fogged up there. Research, regeneration, and education. She's a graduate of the University of Montana's College of Forestry and Conservation and the Davidson Honors College with a degree in resource conservation. She is local here to Southern Oregon. She runs an amazing organization that educates people on the importance of not only pollinators and bees, but just how we preserve the outdoors. My children have been to her presentations at their school. She's an avid outdoors person. A conservationist, doing amazing work here in Southern Oregon and around the country and around the world. I do have to warn you, on the episode I talk about, this is our first ever video episode. We did record the episode with video, but for some reason, this file and the video file got corrupted. This audio file you're about to listen to got the audio file saved, and that was one of the reasons why the podcast was delayed. There's a bunch of others. But couldn't retrieve the video. So we'll talk about it. That's something that is down the pike here soon. And with sponsors like Gregory on board and Canuck Outdoors, that's something that can happen very soon, hopefully. So just wanted to warn you all about that. So without any further ado, my conversation with Sarah Redlaird. I am here with the B-girl herself, Sarah Wood Laird. How are you doing today, Sarah?
I'm good.
Thank you so much for coming on the Hiker Podcast and coming on the show. We want to have you on for such a long time. And I'm excited to have you here in person. This podcast started during the pandemic, so most of our interviews have been Zoom. So this has been really great to have you here, not only in person. I love having Ashland Outdoors Persons here, but also our first video episode. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
So just starting out, tell us who you are, where you come from. If you were to just be, you know, trail running out of Mount Ashland and you run into somebody and you're talking to them, what would you tell them?
Oh, gosh. If I was training running up in Mount Ashland, I'd just probably tell them hi and keep running. but I was actually born here in Ashland.
Nice.
And my dad moved to Southeast Alaska when I was fairly young. He started work up there when I was about 6 months old, and then he moved full time when I was four. And he was a logger and worked in the mills up there. And then when I got older, he was a hunting and fishing guide. And so I kind of split time between my mom here and my dad and my stepmom up in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
My dad obviously is a very enthusiastic, avid outdoors person. And my mom as well. She was one of the first women wildland firefighters on the West Coast.
Oh, wow.
Back in the early 70s. And so not only did I spend a lot of time with my dad trapping in the outdoors and doing all the things that we did, and we lived in a homesteader cabin, so we basically lived in a wooden tent with no plumbing or electricity or anything. So I've always just been really comfortable outside, maybe even more comfortable outside than inside because of that experience. Mm-hmm. And then growing up with my mom, girls and moms and teenage girls don't get along all the time, but the outdoors was where we always could connect and get along, starting when I was little all the way up through now. I mean, we get along great now, but when I was middle school, high school, that was the place that we could really go outside and get along. And so for me, the outdoors isn't only a place of solitude and connection with myself and with my surroundings, but it's the place that I feel really comfortable and really connected to the people that I'm with and really at ease. So
I'm reading your bio here, and I'm I had no idea. I knew you were, I know you were the B-girl. You're locally very well known. You have a huge following on Instagram. I'm just going to read your bio here because I was just like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. You're the founder and executive director of B-Girl Organization, a grassroots nonprofit centered on bee habitat conservation through research, regeneration, education. You are a graduate of the University of Montana's College of Forestry and Conservation and the Davidson Honors College with a degree in resource conservation focused in community collaboration and environmental policy. You serve as the Bees and Kids Program Director for the American Beekeeping Federation. Goes on and on. And you have this, this huge background in the outdoors. You've been a guide, you're backpacking, all these things you do. At what point, and you grew up in Alaska, you were born in Ashland, the outdoors is around you, but at what point were you like, I want this to be what I do? Don't want to go work in office, don't want to do the normal 9-to-5 thing, or white picket fencing. This is my life, this is my passion, this is what I want to do. What was the catalyst for that?
I think it was when I was up in Alaska. Yeah, that's a great question. So let me reel it back a few thousand lifetimes. But so that's what it was. I went up to visit my dad. I was actually working here at the Varsity Theater and then at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just took 3 weeks off to go. I needed a break. I was really overwhelmed. I had been in school and working two jobs. And I also worked at Ashland Street Cinema when that was here. And so I was working three jobs essentially and going to school full time. And I totally burnt out and I needed some time and some space. And so I took 3 weeks off, which meant I kind of had to quit my jobs, but then they were like, well, if it's still here for you, it'll still be here for me when you get back in 3 weeks. And so I was like, okay, well, so I just went up to Alaska for 3 weeks to go just have some downtime and spend time with my dad and be outside. And then I got a job working for a company that did helicopter tours for cruise ship passengers. And so I ended up staying for the rest of the cruise ship season for the next few months. And then from just working in that industry, the cruise industry down on the docks in Ketchikan, I met all of these guides that were kayak guides and hiking guides and I was like, wait, that's a job? You can just go outside and take people outside and get paid for it. And you're all so cool. And I'm going to spend all my time with you people because you're my people. Mm-hmm. And so the next year when I came up, I worked for a guiding company. And then they were all in college studying leading people in the outdoors. And I was like, oh, well, that's what I want to do then. That's what I had been actually a pre-psych major. And I'm still a relentless nerd. But I wasn't super devoted to the track that I was on in pre-psych. And so, yeah, I just made that shift and I ended up going back to, I looked at a lot of outdoor colleges offering outdoor programs, and Central Oregon Community College had a rad program that chatted with the leader of the program, got along really well with him. So I applied and I got in, got scholarships and grants and all the things. And yeah, so I ended up getting a degree in outdoor recreation leadership. And I loved school. I loved Bend. I loved my life there. But I ended up getting an internship with a guiding company back up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I went back up there and then ended up staying there for a few more years than I thought I would, because I met someone and fell in love and wanted to stay. And then there was another transition in my career from guiding and search and rescue and really being super focused on kind of that part of the outdoors. I got this super part-time job over one winter being an outreach and education coordinator for a watershed council. And I got to learn about the wild world of conservation and ecology and biology, and I loved it. I loved being able to teach other people about the outdoors, but in a classroom or in a community mm-hmm. meeting, or I ran a stormwater program for the community that was rad that I really loved. And so I really started falling in love with more of the conservation side of the outdoor world and the science side of the outdoor world. And I never had, it never even was a concept in my mind, even my late 20s, that a woman could be a biologist. Because growing up, all of my dad's buddies that were Fish and Wildlife Service biologists or Alaska fish and game biologists were men. Never in my life had I ever seen a female scientist. Mm-hmm. And so I had no concept that I could even work in conservation growing up. And so I went to a watershed conference called River Rally, and there's 300 people there, and the majority of people there were women working in conservation biology and ecology. And I was just like, what? I can do this too? So that inspired me to shift again and go back to school and get a bachelor's degree in resource conservation. And there I also fell in love with policy. And yeah.
How's it been as a woman in the outdoor industry? How have you been received? Because I mean, the outdoor industry has normally been very, very male dominated.
Yeah.
What's been your reception getting into this industry and having, you have such a huge following and a loud voice now. What's that been like?
Oh, 100%. Like very, very male dominated. I worked in the outdoor industry as a guide like 15 to 20 years ago at this point. These were in my early mid-20s is when I was guiding and working like really solidly in the outdoor industry and working in outdoor shops. And I'm 43 now, so it was a while ago. but that was very front and center. I was not treated the same as the male guides. Mm-hmm. I was not given the same opportunities as the male guides. The lead guide up in Alaska did not treat me equally. I have always been pretty mouthy and stood up for myself. And mm-hmm. so I actually went to his boss and lodged like an official complaint. And then we changed things and I was able to get hours on the schedule and got more opportunities to do cooler hikes and stuff. And so, and also kind of pointed out that the other 1 to 2 women guides as well didn't get very fair treatment. I definitely noticed it then. There's just a lack of representation in the outdoors back then. There wasn't a lot of women guides, and it wasn't very welcoming place to be. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I've kind of inserted myself into male dominated spaces for my whole career, like whether it be the sciences, the beekeeping world, farming and ranching. There are women present, but it's a male dominated industry or a male dominated sector. Yeah. Education and nonprofit management are the only places where I'm actually like amongst a lot of other women leaders. So it's been tough. It was really interesting. I actually had the super triggering experience last year when I got a split board for Christmas, and the pieces that I got for my bindings were wrong. Like, they put two of the same thing instead of all the pieces I need. And the place that my partner had purchased it for me and ordered all the stuff was actually in Bend. It was the closest place he could find a really good split board setup. Mm-hmm. And so we drove to Bend, and we went to an outdoor store in Bend. And I put the board and the pieces up on the counter and was like, hey, I tried putting this together. It just was wrong. And the way I was treated, I think it was even the owner of the store, the way I was treated by him was so disrespectful. And he basically treated me like I was stupid, even though, and then like once he realized that I was right and it was the wrong pieces, mm-hmm. he didn't even apologize for the way that he treated me. And he also treated the other women in the store like one, like another woman, female employee, saw what was going on. She came up to help and to basically stand up for me, and mm-hmm. he totally shot her down. And I was like, I was livid. It took me days to calm down from that. And I almost like wrote him a letter. I almost called a few friends in Bend to find out like exactly who that person is and why they have this position of power and if this is a problem and he needs to know about it. And then I ended up not really doing or saying anything when all was said and done, because it was pandemic times and I was exhausted. And yeah, and I also was just like, well, maybe, I mean, that just sucks that this is still just the way that it is. It just sucks that this is like 2021 and mm-hmm. this is how like women in outdoor stores are still being treated, like as a customer and even as employees. So yeah, I mean, it's alive and well.
Yeah,
even post Me Too.
as much as you like to think that it's changed and you see a lot more women out on social media and out on the trail and, you know, solo hiking and solo climbing, it's a problem that doesn't seem to go away, it boggles my mind. In a place like Bend, which I spent a lot of time in Bend, you think the outdoor industry in Bend is so progressive and so this, and then to hear that, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And there's still so much work to do. How have things changed for the positive? Not only, because you're in this industry, I've only been in this industry for about 2 years, and it's crazy for me to think it's only been 2 years. How has it changed for the better, though, not only for women, but people of color and LGBTQ and others in the outdoor? Because for so long, outdoor has been very cishet, straight, white, male. You know, basically a dude you'd see in a Mountain Dew commercial. Right. That's really what it was long. What have been some maybe the positive things you've seen, knowing that we still have a long way to go?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about it. You and I are sitting here having this conversation. 20 years ago, there's no way. It was like, if you brought up sexist behavior or misogyny in the outdoor industry, it was kind of like, ooh, yeah, I could see that. But then it was kind of brushed under the rug and nobody really wanted to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that there's an awareness. We're talking about it. And just because we're talking about it and there's awareness, like you said, doesn't mean that there's the change currently that needs to be happening. But I hope that the bow is headed in the right direction, mm-hmm. that we're, as an industry and as different communities, we're recognizing it and talking about it. And, you know, now that we're talking about that, I might still just write a strongly worded letter.
When we're done recording, let me know. I go to Bend like twice a month. Let me know not to go there.
I mean, it's the other women that were working in the shop. It was actually, well, interestingly enough, it was, there was more women than men employees, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. And it's a great shop. And the experience that I had with the other employees was awesome. It was just this one guy that just really got to me. And I think he might be an owner, just the way that he was acting, the way mm-hmm. he was talking to people. And I was like, that sucks. That, like, you know, like, it comes from the top down. And so But yeah, the fact that we're just even talking about it, the fact that there has been an awareness around the lack of, we're addressing and talking about the fact that there's lack of POC in the outdoor industries. And so I've been just me, myself, I've been really intentional of seeking out and finding people of color. And I've always been obsessively followed women athletes in the outdoors and tried to support them in any way that I possibly could with just even like shooting the messages on social media or coming up to them at a film screening and letting them know how much I love what they do and how inspiring they are, because those little comments really do work and we do need to hear those things. Mm-hmm. But following, finding accounts to follow on Instagram and giving all the hearts and positive comments and cheerleading from the sidelines that I possibly can. So, I mean, that's also a positive is social media and getting to be able to kind of look out. I mean, Southern Oregon is very white, but just knowing that there are people of color that are out there in the outdoors doing amazing things, and you can find them on social media, and lift them up and celebrate them and share what they're up to. And so I think that that's also a positive. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about social media. I started following you, and you had issue with that wasn't your van, your living situation, and people were, you know, supporting you, and I was like, oh my gosh. And this is before I had any type of following. I just got into the outdoors. I hear so much both positive and negative from outdoorsy people regarding the outdoors. Like, oh, it's been a net negative. Now there's too many people out there. There's just, you know, the trails are overrun with people don't know what they're doing. Other people are like, well, no, the more people we get out there, the more funding we can get, the more awareness there is. You've been in this industry for a while. What's your take on how social media has changed the outdoor landscape? For example, head of the PCT Trail Association years ago had said that the number one thing bringing people to the PCT was Cheryl Strait's book and then the film. Mm-hmm. Now they say it's Instagram. So you see that shift. What have you seen in that time?
There is definitely more people outside and on the trails now than there were years and years ago, for sure. But I love it. I'm in the camp that I'm like, the more the better. Mm-hmm. There's plenty. It's about having either an abundance or a scarcity mentality, you know? Like, I think that there's plenty of outdoor opportunities. I think that there are the more the merrier. But of course, there's always an opportunity for education and for bringing people along on how to be in the outdoors. And so, I mean, social media can also be a force for good. I mean, what you do and how educational your podcast is and what you let people know about, you know, is awesome. I think that there could be, when the pandemic first started and everybody started pouring onto the trails because there was nothing else
to do. Yep.
That was overwhelming because of the amount of overflowing porta potties and pit toilets and the trash and the speakers. But I think that I think a lot of those folks just don't know any better. They probably weren't raised camping and hiking. Yeah. And so they haven't been taught or told. And the coolest thing happened. I took a big road trip in the van this summer, and anywhere that I possibly could, I would look up a trail to go on a run with Midgey, my pup. And there was actually a lot of volunteers from local outdoor nonprofits or trails associations, and then also Park Service staffers that were tabling on the outside of really super busy trails in Montana and Colorado and Wyoming. And they were out there and they had a bunch of information on how to be in the outdoors, mm-hmm. like not to bring your speaker, not to clean up after your dog, even though it is outside. Mm-hmm. And because everybody brings a dog and they're all going right along the trail, like that's going to add up.
Yeah.
And then leave no trace. Like, there was leave no trace educators out there. And so it did take a while from like the onslaught that the pandemic started into the outdoors. But it was really, really cool to see that. And I'm definitely a really independent person, so I did bristle when I first saw like, why is there a table? Like, why is someone tabling in a trailhead? And then I got closer and they were so nice and so sweet and really just there to like stop people and educate them and make sure everybody was filling out their permits and being responsible and keeping their dogs on leashes. But I thought that that was awesome. So I think that there are people that are, there's definitely, it is a problem for people to go out and misuse the outdoors and ruin other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. But it's just about teaching trail manners. You know, like I tell our kids that manners are being conscious of the fact that what you do impacts others. Mm-hmm. And so being really mindful around you, the impact that you're currently having on the people around you. And so that's just what it is like teaching trail manners. And if you don't know, you don't know.
Awesome. It's been weird to see, because I'm one of those people who got into the outdoors right as the pandemic was happening. I'm a city kid. I'm from Las Vegas in Southern California. I mean, yeah. I used to, you know, brag about the fact that I wasn't outdoorsy. I'm mm-hmm. I was living in Southern Oregon. I'm a city kid. Little town, Nashville. What am I doing here? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I discovered, like, what have I been missing my whole life? But I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really having been now in the shoes where I didn't know, and now people are looking to me for like, oh, what is LNT? No, leave no trace. What are these things? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, when I see someone on the trail and they pick up their dog's, you know, poop, you know, they pick it up and they leave on the side of the trail. I'm like, hey, can you not do that? Because a raccoon might get into that, or you're likely just gonna forget it on the way back because you don't know where you put that. So go ahead and just pick that up now. That's
A brilliant trail hack for that I learned from my friend Jackie is just bring an old Nalgene. So like, pick it up with a bag.
That's a really good
idea. And then put it in your Nalgene. Your like old nasty Nalgene that you're never going to use for anything else, and that way it doesn't stink, like it's totally contained, and then just carabiner it onto the back of your backpack or
really
inside
idea.
Your backpack.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Because nobody wants to carry around dog's poop for 10 miles or 3 miles or whatever. But yeah, there you go. Brilliant trail hack.
Yeah, that's awesome. I wish I would have thought about that because I have like 1,000 Nalgenes that I don't use.
Everybody's
anymore.
Got an old Nalgene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's weird to see that dichotomy because I mean, there's times when I get on a trail and I wince. I'm like, oh, there's so many people. What's going on? But then I'm like, that was me once. That was, and I've gained so much benefits from the outdoors. And it's now how I make my living. I get to do these things. And it's only a net positive. The trails and the associations, everything have to catch up because there was this onslaught.
Mm-hmm.
But the outdoors is for everyone and everybody, and you know, trying to keep it to yourself or have your don't tell people where you went on the trail. I get that all the time. Why'd you post the location of that trail? Especially here in Southern Oregon, people have their little spots, and I'm like,
totally.
Yes,
they're public land.
It's public land. This is BLM
land. Our
taxpayer
money is paying for this.
This is in the monument. Yeah. This is BLM land. This is in Crater Lake National Park.
Yeah.
This is in the Redwoods. I've gotten some very hateful messages like, "Why would you do that?" I'm like,
oh, yeah. Like,
it's
my
ridiculous.
Best friend is one of those people. And that's, like, one of the only things that we really butt heads on is she gets really, really, really grumpy if there's any kind of outdoor event or somebody's putting something on social media about a trail or something because – and I'm like, it's not just for you, though.
Yeah.
Like, this is for everyone. And we want more community in the outdoors. We want more community around the outdoors. Like, for me, just safety's sake, I don't want to go splitboarding by myself in the backcountry. I want friends to go with, and I don't have any friends to go with right now. And so I love to go to one of these events and go meet people that I could go splitboarding with or backcountry skiing with more. And so I want more community, so I want more people to become proficient in the outdoors. And then also policy really matters, and voting matters.
Yeah.
And voting for people that believe in our public lands and the sanctity of our public lands and our wilderness areas is important. And you're not going to care about that unless you've had a personal experience with the outdoors and you've been able to get in flow and have connection with the outdoors, which every human has the capacity to do. And you're not going to care unless you've physically done it yourself.
Yeah, and that's where the dollars come from. That's why the trail associations are able to afford to table a trail. I mean, I would love to see that in Southern Oregon more, more in the PCT and some of the monument areas. Shifting gears here a little bit. So now you work with bees.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what you're known for here in Southern Oregon and around the country. How did that happen?
That was another dog leg in academia. Everything kind of shifts around like where I'm what I'm going to school for. So I was at school for resource conservation in Montana, And I had gotten an internship working at the honeybee lab and doing fun, cool, weird research. And along with my like 19 credits and two other internships. But I graduated in 2010 during the last big recession. Mm-hmm. And unlike today, there was no jobs. There was no jobs at all anywhere. Yeah. And I was a super overachiever in college, and basically one of the other nonprofits that I was interning with, that was a water policy focused nonprofit, had kind of built a job for me coming out of school where I'd be working half in Missoula and half in Helena, the capital, and doing lobbying in the capital around water policy. But there was just this also a giant, if you remember the Tea Party in 2010, the kind of fallout after Obama was elected in 2008 that went to push back against environmental policy and climate change and anything good for the outdoors. And so they were really honest and they were like, you know what, like we had like our own version of the Montana Tea Party take over like our Congress, and it's just not going to be fun, and we're probably actually not going to get anything done because my whole job was around climate change and water policy. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, you can still have this job, but like being your first job out of college, it's going to suck. And we probably even won't have enough work for you to offer you more than like 10 to 20 hours a week now at this point. And then so I told the professor at the B-Lab that, and he's like, oh, well, we'll see what we can do. So he was able to pull some money from here and there and created a position for me at the Honeybee Lab working as a researcher full time. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, I'll just do this until I can get back to conservation, real conservation work. Mm-hmm. And I just really loved it. And I loved the research, and I loved working with the bees and working in the lab, and I love the people that I worked with. And then it got to kind of like this weird split in the road where the job available for me going forward was to work for as a subcontractor for a large pharmaceutical / ag chemical company doing research where they were asking the research questions, and I didn't like the questions they were asking. I didn't think that they're asking the right questions to get to the solution of the problem, which is all the bees are dying.
Yeah.
They instead were asking the questions that they know they get the answers to that were very surface and very much to kind of say that like what was going on wasn't their fault. And so I kind of just like did a little pivot away and had come home for the winter in between research seasons here to Southern Oregon. And it just very organically started. I kind of was just that really nerdy person that couldn't stop talking about bees if I was out to dinner with friends or out at the bars or whatever. And then somebody said, oh, have you ever taught a class about, I mean, I'm sure the community would love to hear about your research and what you did. And there's a lot of people that are wanting to become backyard beekeepers. Like, have you ever thought about doing a class here in Southern Oregon? I was like, oh, no, but sure. And so I rented out the community center that now does no longer exist, that our condemned community center. But back then you could rent it out for $15, I think, or $30 or something for the evening for like two or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And I had some friends from high school like take tickets at the door. And and that was my first class. And it was a ton of people showed up, like 40 or 50 people showed up. And it was awesome. And the questions were awesome. And then there was a woman there who was a teacher, and she was like, oh, will you come and talk to my first graders about bees? And I was like, sure. And then that started the kids program. And then everything just kind of rocket ship avalanched from there. And then by the time I needed to go back to work for the research season for the chemical company, I was like, I just don't think I want to do that. Like, I'm sorry. And I know that it actually pays money, but I just feel like I need to stay here and I need to see this through because there's a real demand and a niche for what I can offer to the world. And so that was the beginning of Bee Girl in 2010, 2011.
Awesome.
So
for the listeners who don't know, we have a lot of people who are new to the outdoors. Let's get into nuts and bolts of it. Why are bees important? I mean, my son's attended your class. Like, anytime there's like a little, you know, weed up in the middle of our lawn, and I'm mowing the lawn, he tells me to mow around it because we need to preserve that for the for the pollinators. I'm like, okay, fine. I'll mow around it. Why is this so important? I mean, I know for obvious reasons, but for our listeners who may not know why it's important to preserve, you know, honeybees, you know, I have a slight allergy to bees, so I'm a little back off. I have to carry an EpiPen, so they're a little scary to me. So why are they important though for the ecosystem, and how is climate change affecting their livelihood?
Yeah, in short, they feed us. So honeybees pollinate 1 out of every 3 bites of food that we eat, and the food that they pollinate is the brunt of the color and flavor and nutrition. Strawberries, a lot of our fruits, strawberries, cherries, cotton. You and I are both wearing cotton clothes today, and we can thank honeybees for pollinating our cotton. Money is made out of cotton, so they make our money for us. So they're really connected into so many of the things that we eat and use in our daily lives. And then, and they're really an integral part of agriculture, they're a keystone species. Honeybees are a keystone species, as well as an indicator species in American agriculture. And then we also have, so there's one species of honeybees that are in this country, and they were imported for honey, actually, with the original settlers that were coming in the 1600s. And however, there are 4,000 species of native bees that are here. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of liken them to honeybees are livestock and native bees are wildlife. And the wide world of native bees is also extraordinarily fascinating. And 86%-ish, probably actually more, of our plants in North America have to have a pollinator. Mm-hmm. The rest are wind pollinated or self-pollinating. But those plants need some sort of a pollinator to move pollen around the plant in order for it to be fertilized and then to grow fruit and seeds and live another day. And the vast majority of pollinators, and hands down the most efficient, the best pollinator on the planet, is a bee. They're just made to pollinate flowers. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have to have, in order for nature to function, we have to have bees. And, you know, like, I can connect bees to anything. There's bumblebees in the tundra in Alaska that pollinate berries like kinnikinick that bears survive on in the summertime. And there are bees around our neck of the woods that pollinate shrubbery that make berries that migrational songbirds survive on this time of year. So they really do, they're a connector species, they're an indicator species, they're a keystone species. They really kind of just are the work engines that keep everything going. And then as far as how climate change affects bees, it affects them in many, many, many ways. I mean, one of the just most blatant ways as far as honeybees are concerned is they're directly affected by the extreme weather that is caused by climate change. Like here in the West Coast, fires. Yeah. I get reports every time that there's some sort of a massive fire of both like very beautiful success stories and tragedies. I hear beekeepers will email me about a fundraiser they might have for tens or thousands of bees that they lost in fires, physically got burned up. Every once in a while, I'll get a really beautiful story of a firefighter that went out and wrapped someone's bees in the like fire tinfoil that they have,
stuff, yeah.
Or sprayed them down with water and kept them alive through a forest fire, which is really awesome. Hurricane Ian killed tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of hives of bees, and there's some pretty massive fundraising efforts in the bee community right now to get those beekeepers back on their feet. Mm-hmm. So that's how climate change can directly affect honeybees. But then also, in kind of a very high level look, it's drought, it's extreme weather, it's loss of drought and extreme weather and heat waves that are causing floral landscapes to dry up and disappear, or diversity in floral landscapes to dry up and disappear, where something like blackberry might thrive, then our more sensitive native flowers just can't, there's just not enough water and they can't handle the heat. They just weren't evolved for that. And so, and there's only a certain amount of, there might be like 7 species that are really into blackberry, but then there might be this one special flower and this one special bee that just can't survive the heat and just can't survive the drought. So.
And we were talking before we started recording about how, like, we went summer last week and now we're in winter. There's snow up in Mount Ashland right now. It's cold outside. I pulled out my puffy. I wasn't expecting to do that till like December. So this is happening. Like climate, like it's not debatable. Mm-hmm. But beside this little, I call blue dot in Ashland, we live in a very, very conservative part of Oregon. People think Oregon's very, very liberal, and it is because of Portland controls our politics. But the state, especially in the more rural parts, are tend to be a little more conservative. And I'm always fascinated. I love to talk to environmental educators in Southern Oregon who, you know, teach this stuff. How do you do such a good job of talking about bees and climate change in an area where people don't really believe it may even be happening? How do you communicate that? And then you have these kids who are saying, "Dad, don't mow the lawn right there because we need to save the bees." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, I'll do them. Whatever." And how do you do that? Because I'm seeing educator after educator communicate that so effectively. And I'm just like, my own daughter goes to a magnet school out in Gold Hill, and her teachers are very, for lack of a better term, just very environmentally friendly, let's say. And in an area that you see a lot of flags you don't want to see on people's houses. Mm-hmm. And yet you have all these kids who are excited about the environment. Like, what the heck?
Yeah.
How do you go about that in an area such as this, in a more rural area that doesn't really maybe take the environment and climate change as seriously as we would like?
Yeah. One of our board members is actually a classroom teacher at a school in Rogue River. And he is he has a degree in environmental education from SOU, and he's very environmentally focused. And I'm just like, that's rad.
Yeah,
good for you. And what a hero. I'm lucky because everybody loves bees. Bees aren't really a controversial topic. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves honey. Everybody loves bees. Everybody understands that bees, I mean, for the most part, people at this point, it's been so long that a lot of people haven't even heard of colony collapse disorder, which was kind of this phenomena that started in 2006, 2007 that got everybody's attention about the importance of bees. But it's been so long now, nobody even talks about or knows about colony collapse disorder anymore. They just know that the bees are important and we need to save them. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that. I've always taught around positivity and love and passion, and I do not try to scare children into thinking that all the bees are dying, so they better hurry up and start acting right. Like, I'm there to create a love relationship between kids and bees, or even adults and bees. And I get complaints from parents because they're like, "Why didn't you talk about pesticides?" And I was like, because I don't have to. Like, I don't have to scare your kids into loving bees and like growing up to be bee conservationists. I can inspire them to love bees, and that emotion is so much more, it's just so much more long lasting. If you are like fired up because you don't like something, or you're scared, or there's fear, it's such a flash emotion. Like, it's big and it's a flash, and you might like, but it's, you can burn out literally figuratively really easily. And so I just try and kindle it with love and fascination. And so I love bees so much, and they have so many cool, there's so many cool, weird, awesome, fun facts, and kids love fun facts, and they love to know things, and they love even like the macabre, weird part of bees. And so I just kind of like, I get them really excited about cool facts that they can tell their friends, or they can tell their parents, or they can just know, and then they feel like they know things that are easy to remember and really cool. And then that really kind of fosters this fascination and curiosity, I think, because I run into folks often. I love hearing the story that you shared about that your son was in one of our programs, because I hear that all the time around Ashland, which is so cool. And like the other day, there was the woman that sang at our fundraiser. she said, oh, my kid went to your Kids and Bees program like 10 years ago and he still talks about bees all the time. And so I love that because it shows that really, really, really cultivating an interest and a curiosity is what's going to raise our little bee conservationists in the future. So I guess that's how I do it, is just I get people as excited as I am through sharing just how amazing and fascinating this species is.
And it's funny, like with my daughter, like we go hiking and you put on repellent. She's like, no, Dad, we need to get some citronella essential oil. I'm like, what? She's like, no, it's non-toxic and it'll keep them away. And if bugs or anything get around you, it's not going to hurt them. I'm like, I guess we're going to order some citronella essential oil.
And it's better for you, too.
That's bringing all the chemicals on you. What is, though, like, I think I know the answer to this is, but what is the consequence of continued climate change and continued loss of bee habitats and these colonies? What is the consequence for the environment and for humans if something doesn't happen, if we don't begin to take this seriously, not only on a personal level of families and in your backyard when you mow your lawn, but on a governmental and policy level?
Yeah. You know, the first thing that just popped into my head was I thought, what's on the table right now is loss of pleasure and enjoyment in the outdoors. That's where we're heading. And that's what makes me really, really, really sad and makes me want to keep doing what I'm doing in any way I can to help fight climate change, is that I spent 6 weeks living in my van on the road and living on farms and ranches in the Great Basin and in the Mountain West and in the Pacific Northwest last summer. And it was really not a pleasure. It was hot. It was super hot. The loss of beauty in these places that I basically came into my own in my 20s in the outdoors in Montana. I went back to the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem for the first time in many, many, many years. And I was beside myself with the lack of floral diversity that was out there that I remember seeing when I lived there as a student. Mm-hmm. And I, in my head, had, like, envisioned just, like, such a comfortable summer, living in the van, 82 degrees, flowers everywhere. I mean, I, even just 6-7 years ago, I was teaching summer camps in Montana outside of, for the Farmers Union outside of Great Falls. And it was, like, so comfortable, so beautiful, such a pleasure to be out there. So nice to get away from the wildfire smoke here in Southern Oregon and get out there to just, like, the best temperature and the most beautiful flowers and afternoon rainstorms, you know. And this summer was brutal. It was 96 degrees. It was 110 inside the van because I didn't have an air conditioning unit because I didn't think I would need one because it's Montana. And South Dakota, North Dakota. And I'm what's at risk is like what we're talking about, like, and why we why you and I exist in the world is to thrive in the outdoors and share that with people and bring more people along with us into the outdoors so they can also thrive as human beings from the pleasures that we can get from being in a flow state in the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And if climate change keeps going the way that it's going, we're not going to have that anymore. Like, that's not going to be accessible to anyone. We're going to have to go to like mountaintops of Colorado or Alaska or something in order to have comfortable experiences. And that's no longer going to be accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it was like remarkably less flowers, shockingly less floral diversity, shockingly less beauty. Everything was so crispy, so hot, so uncomfortable. There was a massive flood in Yellowstone this year that completely changed the river. I had a really hard time even finding anywhere to swim because of like how much the river has changed. Mm-hmm. That felt safe. Like it was either like really, really fast or really, really shallow or just like just very uncomfortable. So I think that that's what we're at risk of. And then on top of that, we're at risk of losing, you know, like we're just now the country that North America is starting to do some really, really cool coming together around finally getting some baseline data as far as bees so we can say definitively what's happening. Because right now, nobody really knows. There hasn't really been a countrywide melittology study since like the age of discovery in the 1800s, really. Like, and so there are universities and governmental agencies that are like, as we speak, I'm on the and part of the group that's forming, like, how can we as a country all get together to start taking baseline data for native bee species to be able to see how climate change and other factors like agriculture are affecting them as we move forward. But it's not going to be good. I think we're going to find cool, weird, neat bee species that we didn't think were places that they are. But I think what we're going to find is that we are, we know that we have a bumblebee here in Southern Oregon in Ashland that's endemic to Mount Ashland called Franklin's bumblebee, Bombus franklinii. And she's gone. Like, oh, wow. She's not coming back. And it happened in 15 years.
Gosh. And it's so weird for me to think because I moved here from Las Vegas in 2007. Las Vegas, every year, you know, you get 110, 120, normal for the middle of the desert. This summer, I'm looking, you know, I came here in 2007. It was, you know, in the summer, you'd have a couple of 100-degree days. It wasn't too bad. You know, this last year, I'm looking at the temperatures in August. It's hotter here than in my home in Las Vegas. And it's like, yeah. When that was unheard of 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Never happened. You'd have a few couple hundred. It always happened when I visited here. I'd come visit like, oh, you brought the heat with you. Mm-hmm. It always happened that weekend. And people just don't realize how that is changing. I talked to PCT hikers, the PCT days this year, and they're like, I see all these videos of people going out and hiking from 2015, 2016. And it's beautiful. And it's like, there's all these fire closures. They've had to skip and skip. And the smoke is debilitating. And it's like, you can't do a complete through hike anymore. And I know for myself, I didn't do any hiking in the Rogue Valley region in August to September. I went up to the gorge or I went over to the coast because I just couldn't do it. It was too mm-hmm. hot and too smoky.
Yeah.
And it's right in front of us, but I think unless if you're in the outdoors, you can see it. And I'm wondering if people aren't really going to take it seriously until it actually affects them.
Yeah. And I wonder then even if they'll like make the connection mm-hmm. that, yeah, like, wow, like that just like, I mean, my boyfriend, his name's Hal Kerner, and he's an ultra runner and was a professional ultra runner for a long time with the North Face. And he co-directs and organizes quite a few races around town. And then we help out at an aid station down at Western States Ultra Marathon, which is like kind of this iconic, it was the first official ultra marathon. So 100 miles, mm-hmm. runners run 100 miles from South Lake Tahoe to Auburn, California. And this year, the weather was a bit more cooperative, but last year, oh my Lord, like people were dropping like flies because yeah. It was so hot. They just couldn't do it.
I was supposed to hike the Tahoe Rim Trail that summer and just couldn't do it.
Oh my gosh. Then this year has the last race that he ran and organized, I think he had something like 40% of people dropped out because it was so hot. They couldn't do it. They just were, it was inhumane to, and so, but then, but I don't know. I don't see the trail running or the ultra running community talking about climate change. Mm-hmm. I don't see it on their Instagrams. I don't hear it on their podcasts. I don't see anybody like really, really advocating for climate resilience or talking about climate change. And so I'm like, wow, that's really interesting because of climate change, we are having inhumanly inhospitable heat waves mm-hmm. in what was formerly a really calm climate, and that is very much affecting the bottom line of this race and the running community and the health of the running community.
Yeah.
But why isn't everybody out in the streets?
Yeah,
like why isn't everybody right? Like why isn't there more like even climate initiatives at these big ultra races? And yeah, I mean, there are like some outdoor, like Protect Our Winters mm-hmm. is a really amazing nonprofit that's really connected into the outdoor space and talking about climate change. And they basically are like advocating for solutions to climate change because they want snow, and it's mostly skiers and snowboarders.
Yeah.
And so I would love to have like, can we have a nonprofit that does protect our summers, that like, we don't want to live on a hellscape.
Yeah.
We don't want to live and out and recreate in an inhospitable and humane hellscape.
And that would be amazing. Whether it's, you know, your family day hikers and your through hikers and your ultra runners and your climbers, you know, the fact that you're looking for, especially in the Pacific Northwest, it's wet, it's rainy, and you're looking forward to the summer gets here and you get like 3 good weeks and then all of a sudden it's, you know, hell-like temperatures, you're like, and then you have to drive, which you don't, you know, I love the Southern Oregon because I live near the monument. I live near all the stuff. I live 5 minutes from Table Rock. I can just climb up there whenever I want. You know, I don't want to have to drive 2.5 hours to the Redwood Forest. I love the Redwood Forest, but why, just to enjoy the outdoors, I need to, you know, waste that carbon to get out in temperatures that are below 80 degrees.
Yeah.
You know? And it's something that I think the outdoor community really needs to kind of pay attention to. It really hit me this summer at PCT days, talking to hiker after hiker, and they're just so disheartened and so, and even at PCT days at the gorge, you know, last two times I went, it was cloudy and wet, and this time it was just blazing hot. And like, it's never that hot at PCT days. What can we do? So what can hikers, day hikers, through hikers, climbers do to begin to make an impact and not only encourage, you know, our governments to make policy that will help stem the tide? I mean, maybe it's too late, maybe it's not, maybe we can make it not as bad. But also, you know, the outdoor industry, these companies, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. You know, you have the founder of Patagonia, he's going to put all his time and money into that. And that's one company. Patagonia is an amazing company, but you have so many other companies whose job it is to make money. They have these resources. What can the outdoor industry and outdoors people do to really, what can we do to make this change? Not only just for climate change, but to protect our food with pollinators. You know, we don't have pollinators. We have, and you know, we already have a hard enough time getting food right now with, you know, supply chain issues and stuff. What can we do?
So many things. I would love to see more of an integration of the outdoor industry and the regenerative and sustainable agriculture movements. I think that there's so much interesting synchronicity there because agriculture is in the out of doors. And we need a healthy, clean outdoor space in order to recreate in. And we can't have that if we have conventional chemical agriculture that is taking a toll on our earth through the direct chemicals that they're pouring onto our landscapes, and then also the massive petroleum that it takes to make fertilizers and to make a lot of these monocrops. I went out to look at to go help this summer on a project that's a massive chemical spill from a ethanol. It's a corn. It's basically a receiving plant for pre-treated, unplanted corn. So pre-treated with a petroleum-based systemic pesticide that can, so this corn can be planted and it's so incredibly toxic, no weed or no insect is going to get close to it. And then we basically put that into our gas tanks in the form of ethanol, or it gets fed to cows in CAFOs. And so all of this pre-treated, unplanted, because of the surplus in this country and overproduction of corn, goes to these different plants. And then this one plant basically got nailed because a friend of mine, Dr. Judy Wu Smart, has a research apiary near there. And as soon as they started receiving all of this surplus corn and then not processing it correctly, and because it was so toxic, they can't get the chemicals off of the corn, they haven't been able to figure out a way to detoxify this product to be able to, their whole thing was going to be biochar, but they can't even cook the chemicals off of it. And they tried, and then they sent it off to a farm, and then the amount of chemicals that was in the biochar was through the roots. Like, it was like violated every single EPA law out there. Mm-hmm. And so basically there's just corn that they're receiving and they're getting paid to receive that's just getting like stocked up in football field size piles, and then it's leaching out into the whole entire community and mm-hmm. environment. And it poisoned all of her bees to death year after year after year, and she finally pinpointed what was going on. But that comes back on all of us. That comes back on driving cars and eating cheap fast food meat, and then it's also like you can't even, so there's no recreation to be had about around there. And there's rivers and there's some beautiful landscapes, but one of the researchers was taking her dog along with her to collect data, and her dog got really sick and almost died just from the amount of toxins that he sucked up through his paws. Mm-hmm. So how what a bummer is that we can't even take our dogs on a walk with us when we're out doing like biological research. So I kind of like went a little sideways there, but like I'm basically the point is if anybody who drives a car is responsible for this chemical spill in Mead, Nebraska, which is where it is. And so I think that we just need to take more responsibility as individuals to make choices on our own lives about what can we do to utilize public transportation? What can we do to utilize moving towards electric cars, even though that's not the best solution? The best solution is more public transportation, more bike riding, more. Mm-hmm. And then also our food system. I think if we can really, really make a difference in eating locally and seasonally, I think we can make a huge difference in our environmental health, and then in climate change, by making really solid eating choices through shopping at the farmer's market. Like, tomorrow is the farmer's market here in Ashland, and I'll be going on my bike with my backpack to go do my shopping for the week. And it's cheaper. Like, our farmer's market, it's less expensive to buy from our local farmers than it is at a lot of our grocery stores.
Oregon SNAP program, you can use your SNAP benefits, but a lot of places you can't do that. Unfortunately, a lot of places it is cheaper to go buy the fast food burger than to buy fresh produce, which is
totally
horrible.
So that's policy, and policy is a huge part of it. So we need better policy in this country that makes good local chemical-free food available to everyone. And that's a policy issue. We also, you know, like, we can make every single positive environmental change in our lives and be like the most perfect human being, and we're just going to be a drop in the ocean compared to the polluters that are doing the big polluting, oil and gas, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a really amazing podcast that was started by Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And I cannot believe that the name of it is escaping my brain, but I'll think of it. And it's the solutions-based podcast. And sometimes it's a little hard to listen to because they get really, really into what exactly is going on. But they really encourage you to. There's a whole entire podcast about, like, if you have money on the stock market, how to divest it from fossil fuels. And if you're banking with a large bank, like, how to make sure that you're banking correctly so you're not supporting the fossil fuel industry. So it's really accessible, really interesting. They have a whole episode on sustainable regenerative agriculture and beef. They have a whole episode on kelp farming that's really fascinating. So it's really, really, and every single episode is really solutions based. And I think that there's a lot that we can in the outdoor industry. You know, we're people who care about the outdoors and who are affected by climate change. And so, and there's another thing that I would definitely point everyone towards. And this is a fun one for people who are super passionate and super passionate about the outdoors and have some sort of cool niche thing that we do. There is an Instagram account called All We Can Save. And there's this All We Can Save Venn diagram that you can do. And I'm going to space exactly what the three circles are, but it's something along the lines of, what are you good at? What do you like to do? And what do you want to do? And then you kind of play around with this Venn diagram and you come up with like really individual, cool climate change solutions for what you specifically can do. And where does everything kind of come to middle in the middle? And what are the one or two things that you can do that actually are fun and cool and you like doing? And it's something that only you can do that nobody else can really do. So I think there's an Instagram account called All We Can Save Venn Diagram.
Awesome.
And I would love to see the outdoor industry and folks that live and work in the outdoor industry to do their Venn diagram and see what they could come up with.
Because there's so many things you can do, whether it's, you know, you love myself, film and media, or you just love fashion and you can, you know, advocate for sustainable practices within these, these companies that are not using, you know, cheap cotton and things like that.
Yes. So cotton is one of the dirtiest crops in America, and it is one of the most heavily subsidized crops in America. So that is a huge impact that the outdoor company could have. Any outdoor company that uses cotton in their products could do a much better job at advocating for chemical-free, regeneratively grown cotton, because those honeybees that go in to pollinate those crops oftentimes don't come out alive.
Yeah, and it's funny because you have, and that trend is starting to happen. You have Patagonia has done it, and now other companies are like, oh well, we got to, it's capitalism working in favor for the environment. It's like, oh, people, this is trendy, so you know, other companies are starting to follow suit. And I'm sure other companies will, you know, like organic food, like, is it really organic? You know, there's different things people do.
Yeah.
But it could be a net positive if one or two companies begin to do this or have done it. We see other companies follow suit. And then, you know, all of a sudden the fashion industry is like, oh, wait, you know, these environmentally conscious outdoor companies are doing this. We need to follow suit. And you have the bigger fashion companies, and it just goes down the filter there. There's so many things we could do. We could talk forever more, but if people want to see what you're doing or support what you're doing, support your work, where would they go?
Our website is bgirl.org, www.bgirl.org, and our website for our kids stuff is kidsandbees.org. I'm also pretty active on social media, and that's at Sarah Bgirl, SarahBeegirl.
Awesome. And I ask every guest this at the end of the show. Ultimately, how has the outdoors changed you? That's a big question, but
I don't know if it changed me more than it formed me. I've been going in the outdoors since I was a baby, and I don't remember a time ever not being outside. And I feel like almost all of the photos in the album, for the most part, when I was a kid, were me outside, like hunting or fishing or trapping or hiking or camping or doing something. So I think I am who I am today and every day because the outdoors formed me to be who I am. And I don't know if I think different experiences that I have in the outdoors over time, because I'm outside all the time, probably do change me. But we all are in flux and are changing all the time. So I would, again, just kind of throw it to say that it's more like a formation instead of a change.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. Yeah. And love to have you on again sometime, talking more your work and what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode. I appreciate you all. You all are amazing. You all are awesome. Make sure you follow Sarah at bgirl.org. She's doing amazing things, not only in Southern Oregon, but around the West, around the country, and around the world. Well, the impact of what she's doing has impacts around the world. That was a really, really good conversation. And I listening to it again, I'm like, oh, wow, I forgot what a good conversation that was. And shame I got it out so late. But thank you all for your patience. And nothing else to say this episode, except for if you want more information on me or the podcast, go to hikerpodcast.com. If you want to just find out more about me, there's a little tab there. You click on that. All my information's there. And we'll be getting more stuff on the podcast here, podcast website here soon. Wanting to do blogs and other things on that platform. So, again, thank you all for your patience. Thank you to the sponsors, Canuck Outdoors and Gregory Mountain Products, for allowing this episode to happen. And with that, thank you for listening to this week's episode, finally, of the Hiker Podcast.